Hello, this is UCL Uncovering Politics. This week we ask, how should politicians' behaviour be regulated? How, that is, can we best ensure that politicians are honest, play fair, and do a decent job? Hello, my name is Alan Rennick, and welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics, the podcast of the School of Public Policy and Department of Political Science at University College London. Questions about politicians' behaviour have been high on the political agenda here in the UK in recent months and years. Boris Johnson's premiership was dogged and ultimately ended by allegations that he was serially dishonest and tolerated bullying and other misconduct from his inner circle. Liz Truss sidelined independent sources of expertise and presided over a catastrophic policy failure. And Rishi Sunak, though he entered Downing Street promising integrity, professionalism and accountability, appointed a Home Secretary who only 6 days previously had left government for breaching the ministerial code, installed two other ministers against whom there are allegations of bullying, and is yet, at least at the time of recording, to appoint an ethics advisor. So how can we ensure high standards of behaviour from our politicians? Can we rely simply on political accountability and the disciplining role of the ballot box? Or do advisors, regulators, and perhaps even judges need to play a role as well? Well, here to chew over such questions, I'm delighted to be joined by two real experts. Robert Hazell is Professor of Government and the Constitution here in the UCL Department of Political Science. He founded the UCL Constitution Unit in 1995 and remained its director until 2015. And over the summer, he co-authored a Constitution Unit report on constitutional watchdogs. And Sir Peter Riddle is Honorary Professor in the UCL Department of Political Science. He had a distinguished career as a journalist, lasting 4 decades, serving as political editor of the Financial Times and chief political commentator at the Times. He was director and chief executive of the Institute for Government between 2012 and 2016, and among a range of public service roles in recent years, he was Commissioner for Public Appointments from 2016 until 2021. Welcome, Robert and Peter, both to UCL Uncovering Politics. And we'll get on to the question of how to ensure good behaviour in a moment. But could we start by considering why we should care about politicians' behaviour and standards of behaviour in the first place? Robert, do standards of politicians' behaviour really matter? And if so, why?
Absolutely, they matter. For a fundamental reason, if we are to go on having trust in our politicians and our political system, we must be able to rely on them to be honest and to tell the truth. Those are two really important fundamentals. And just to give recent examples, during the COVID crisis, there were a series of allegations of possible conflicts of interest in the letting of very big government contracts for protective equipment and the like. And if there were conflicts of interest, and if ministers and all their advisers were acting in ways that were dishonest, then that is both corrupting of public trust, and it also erodes confidence in good management of the public finances. In terms of telling the truth, that's a very live issue because the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson is currently the subject of investigation by the Parliamentary Privileges Committee on whether he misled Parliament. That may sound rather abstruse and esoteric, but it is fundamentally important that parliamentarians and we, the public, can rely on ministers when they're giving answers in Parliament to tell the truth. Ministers are, if you like, the drivers of the bus of the government machine. The rest of us are passengers. We have to be able to rely on the driver of the bus to tell the truth about where the bus is going, how long it would take, and in particular, if anything is going wrong, to tell us what the risks are. And because of that huge gap in information between government ministers and backbench MPs and the wider public, we have to rely on government to tell the truth when they are answering questions in Parliament.
Peter, do you want to add to that?
Not really. Any kind of historical point that, in a sense, the public, in the wider sense, have never really trusted politicians. Remember, there's a line in the National Anthem about their knavish tricks, and you can read plenty in Shakespeare about scepticism about politicians. So there's a long standing, and the battles are over the holding politicians to account for truthfulness, also for not being corrupt. I mean, that was one of the big battles of the 18th and early 19th century against the old corruption. So some of the battles are very long standing. I think it has changed historically with a less deferential society, obviously the mass franchise. Also, over the course of the last 50 years, and indeed in my career as a journalist, which you referred to, Alan, it was very much a closed, when I first became a political journalist 41 years ago, it was a kind of closed world. Now, that's completely ended, with some downsides as well as generally strong upsides. So the public has been more demanding and equally more suspicious. And one of the paradoxes which we can address is that the arrival of various standards watchdogs hasn't increased trust in politicians, even though in many cases, perhaps not over the last few years, but over the course of the last 25 years, standards have improved in many areas, but the public don't believe it. Because that is one of the paradoxes. If you have regulators, if you look at it, people think, well, there must be something wrong, and it doesn't necessarily reassure. And that's one of the, actually, I regard as not an argument against regulation, but doing it in a transparent and open manner.
And what you've just said there, I think, will surprise many people, Peter. You've just suggested that standards have improved. And I think when people look at standards under Boris Johnson in particular, perhaps Liz Truss as well, then they would be very sceptical of the suggestion that standards during this period are higher than they were under Margaret Thatcher, under John Major, under Tony Blair.
Well, two things. One, I did actually put in perhaps an understated clause saying perhaps not the last few years. And secondly, okay, Look at across the... You know, we tend naturally to focus on central government, prime minister and things like that. But if you look across the wide range, for example, local government, Robert quite rightly referred to some of the really concerning things about the award of contracts during COVID. But in general, the award of contracts, both centrally and locally, we've got a cleaner system than many countries. There's an extensive audit system. Even in my old area of public appointments, if you go pre the mid-90s, when I was what's called pre-Nolan and the establishment of the Committee on Standards of Public Life, it was then entirely a patronage system. Now, there are problems, and I won't deny some of them have got worse during the period when I was commissioner, under the Johnson and later administrations. I wouldn't deny that at all. But that only applied to a small number of appointments. For many, the system is more transparent and fairer now than it was, say, 30 years ago. So one shouldn't exaggerate. I mean, I think the problems are very serious. I mean, some of the ones Rob and I would totally agree on, which happened under Johnson, are very serious indeed. But you shouldn't confuse that with the system as a whole. I think in many respects, standards, because there's greater transparency, are clearer. Certainly, in public appointments or one or two other areas like that, for a very high percentage of appointments, it's a fair, if imperfect, system.
Robert, you've also been around British politics for quite a few years. How would you characterise the patterns of change over time in standards?
I agree with Peter. I think standards have gradually improved with the tightening up of the system, particularly in the example Peter gave over public appointments, which are no longer nakedly pure patronage and tap on the shoulder. I can give the other example in appointments of judicial appointments, which used to be purely the choice of the individual Lord Chancellor, and again a tap on the shoulder, now regulated by the Judicial Appointments Commission, and it's a very much more merit-based appointments process. Even in appointments to the House of Lords, we do now have a commission, the House of Lords Appointments Commission, which seeks to regulate that aspect of prime ministerial patronage, although, as we may come on to, it is at the moment a rather weak body which badly needs strengthening.
And so that's appointments. If we think about honesty, is it true, do you think, that politicians are more willing to lie today than in past decades?
I mean, that varies depending on the individual and the administration. I think certainly under Johnson, standards have slipped compared, say, with a prime minister like Thatcher, who was a former barrister. She greatly respected the rule of law. She had a lot of respect in particular for her Lord Chancellor, Lord Mackay. And I think standards slipped. We shouldn't focus solely on Johnson. They started to slip badly under Cameron. Cameron, both when Prime Minister and also as an ex-Prime Minister, I find it hard to think of any other post-war Prime Minister who might have lobbied government in the shameless way that Cameron did on behalf of Greensill, the financial services company that subsequently went bust. So if there has been a slide in the last 10 years or so, I would say it started with Cameron.
Peter? Well,
I wouldn't dispute that. One's got to bear in mind, one of the biggest lies in politics was goes back a very long time, 66 years, to the Suez Crisis, when the Prime Minister absolutely deceived the British public and Parliament over the reasons for the invasion. And, you know, they brought him down. Well, the failure of the Suez Enterprise brought him down. People have lied before. I think one of the changes is that there is much more public exposure. It's much less a closed world. It's harder for politicians to keep things because, one, there are a lot of gossipy people around. The rise of special advisors and so on has made a much more exposed world, plus social media. I mean, the world of when there were daily newspapers and rather constrained BBC and ITV news has gone, totally gone. And now it's what's next on Twitter. And that can expose very quickly someone being dishonest and so on. And I think the question is, how much are we, under all kinds of extreme political pressures, being through a rogue phase of the last few years, or is it something which needs correcting, that the assumptions of self-regulation, which applied in the past, or minimal or weak regulation, as Robert rightly points out in terms of the House of Lords Appointments Commission, do they need strengthening because we've had rogue prime ministers? And I agree with Robert, some of the problems. I mean, the lobbying one on Greensill by David Cameron, I found completely inexplicable. It's also extremely stupid too. But the extent to which you therefore need to change the framework, or do you just say we've just gone through a bad patch? I mean, there's a parallel, interesting parallel with the House of Commons, where Speaker Bercow, who was after all Speaker only up to 3 years ago, pushed the limits a lot and appeared to side and was regarded as partisan by particularly the Brexiteers. But was that just an extreme speaker in extreme circumstances? You can argue that the system has corrected itself with its successor. That is not necessarily a satisfactory argument in relation to aspects of the executive.
And you take us on there directly to the next question, which is, how should standards be upheld? So I think we've discussed that standards clearly matter. We've discussed that there's a problem in the UK. There's an interesting story about the trajectory of that problem over time, but it's clear that there is a problem and we would like things to be better. So the next question, Peter, is, well, how can we uphold these standards? You've pointed there towards one mechanism, which is self-regulation, and perhaps that will come back and be stronger over the coming period. But there's also, of course, the force of politics, political accountability, and there are all these various regulators and so on that both of you have already mentioned. How should we be doing this?
Well, I think the political accountability, that gets the nub, to my mind, of the argument. I was very struck in the recent debate in the House of Lords on Lord Norton Lowth's bill to strengthen the House of Lords appointment process, which received the support of 25 out of 27 speakers in the debate. And it was a very good debate. The government's defence, or the limited government defence, didn't convince most Conservative peers, let alone others, was that the Prime Minister is accountable for his nominations. and that accountable to Parliament and accountable to the electorate. That was basically laughed out by peers there, including some ex-MPs who said in standing elections, they never, ever heard nominations to the House of Lords raised on the doorstep. Why should they when it's cost of living, health service and so on? So, and equally, accountability to the House of Commons is very, very weak for a lot of nominations. So I think that's why using that as an argument, which it was used almost in a quasi-presidential way. You know, we have a general election, the Prime Minister's there. That was one of the defences of Boris Johnson, that he had a mandate from that, and that was his accountability. I don't think that's satisfactory. I think that if, as we've seen in the last few years, the previous conventions have broken down, it's not purely a system of self-regulation, because that's where the constitutional watchdogs have come in. All of them have been created in relation to crises or perceptions of scandal. If you go through the last 30 years, you can tick them off in relation to when there was a scandal and when there was a row and so on. The argument now is, are they strong enough? And I'm very suspicious of the argument that you should entrust the executive with all power. The question is the balance. And I think the really difficult issue, and it's one where you could argue it goes back to Charles I, many things do. Just to say that an elected government can do what it wants almost, which is implicit in some of the defences of government action, is not satisfactory. Certainly that the ultimate decisions, I mean, for example, give the example that Robert gave of the Judicial Appointments Commission, which is the strongest form of regulation in constitutional terms we've got, where one name or series of names are put up and the Lord Chancellor can accept or reject. And that's the tightest. In my old area of public appointment, it's a range of names which are judged appointable. So you could argue that, yes, ministers should have the final say, but how constrained should their say be? And that's where the debate is. And I think where the government is resisting, in a number of areas, any incursion on what might describe as executive privilege.
And Robert, do we find different patterns in relation to kind of different standards, I guess? So Peter is talking there about appointments and making the point already that there are differences between judicial appointments and some other appointments. If we go to wider ethical standards around honesty, for example, presumably there's a greater role for the political process there and a lesser role for accountability. There's a greater role for the political process there and a lesser role for regulators. How should we understand what the balance between these different factors should be?
Well, I think Peter put it very well in saying that with all these different regulators, the trick is to find the right balance, and it does vary. Let me give you one example in relation to the regulation of the conduct of MPs, which has had a regulator now for almost 30 years, called the Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards, an office originally proposed in a very early report from the Committee on Standards in Public Life. And I think we're now about to come on to our seventh holder of that office. But when it began, it was a fairly weak office. And memorably, the second holder of that office, Liz Filkin, was not reappointed because in trying to regulate MPs' conduct and behaviour, she irked enough MPs that they wanted to see the back of her. As a result, more recently, the holders of that office have been appointed for a single non-renewable term, so that MPs no longer have the power to say, we don't like this irksome regulation, away with the regulator. The Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards comes under a House of Commons Select Committee, now called the Standards Committee. And just in recent years, in the last 10 years or so, in order to ensure that it isn't simply a system of self-regulation, where the risk is obvious that MPs could be a little lenient towards one of their own, there have been introduced independent members, non-MPs, onto that committee, starting, I think, about 10 years ago with just three of them. There are now seven independent members on the Standards Committee and seven MPs. And when doing our project for a report called Parliament's Watchdogs, if I may, let me trail that, a recent publication by the Constitution Unit on our website, I interviewed the chair of the Standards Committee, Chris Bryant, and he said it's really interesting now that there are seven independent members. In effect, they are the dominant voice on the committee, because as the chair, I only have a casting vote. And so, in effect, the independent members can outvote the MPs 7-6. And so that's a history of how, in one regulator, the balance has gradually evolved towards strengthening the independent element in the committee that supervises the regulator. And as a result, I would argue, has also greatly bolstered the independence of the regulator himself. It is about to be a man. The last two regulators have been women. And the regulator I've been talking about is the Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards.
And you're clearly implying there that independence is a key feature of an effective regulator.
Absolutely. And this is the tension with all the regulators between the need for a very high degree of independence, but they must also be accountable. In particular, they must be accountable to politicians and to the political process if politicians are to have confidence in the regulator who is regulating their conduct and their behaviour.
Mm-hmm. Peter?
I would draw a distinction, and it's an important one, between the parliamentary regulators and those concerned with the executive, because I think it has been, I wouldn't say easier, that's the wrong way to put it, it's been possible to create the independent element which Robert so clearly describes in Parliament after lots of struggles and so on. But with the executive is always determined to retain the ultimate control. Ultimate control in two ways. Of nominating the regulators, that there may be an independent panel, but ultimately the choice of regulators is made by the executive. And secondly, defining the terms on which they operate. That if I give a personal example, in an open process 6.5 years ago, but the decision to appoint me was taken by David Cameron in his last years, and in fact Matt Hancock before he
that
went.
That was the
on
decision to appoint you as commissioner for public appointments. Yep.
And I did have a pre-appointment hearing, a demanding one, and so on. That was fine, and I actually would favour much stronger parliamentary involvement, but that's something we can come on to. But ultimately, that and also the code in which I operated, whilst I managed to modify it and change some of the proposals, was ultimately the executive's code. In many respects, I wasn't opposed to that because it did make it clear the terms on which I was operating. There wasn't an ambiguity, which there had been previously. But that is an example, and it's echoed in other areas. I mean, the classic is the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments, which deals with the jobs which ex-ministers and ex-senior civil servants can take on. And as its current chairman, Lord Pickles, himself a former Tory cabinet minister, but a notably independent one, has complained they really do have no sanctions at all over the what they can do. They can write a complaining letter and publish it. They can't constrain anything. And and the executive is just reluctant to take tougher action. And one's got to bear that in mind, that both the appointees and the framework in which they operate are very much determined by the executive. And it's, as Robert said, it's a balance, but it's a balance which, to my mind, needs strengthening on the accountability and transparency side.
And, I mean, I guess one way of removing executive control over these matters would be to put the framework of these regulators into law, such that the executive can't just decide how it wants things to work at any given point in time. Peter, in your view, would that be a good idea to set down the parameters of the regulators in law?
I would indeed. I think the word parameters, Alan, is a very good one. There obviously has got to be discretion and there is a balance in practice. But I could have been abolished with an order in council, which would have been a bit huffing and puffing, but that would have been true. Some bodies are even weaker. They're completely advisory, and the Prime Minister could wake up this morning and say, I don't want X or Y body. I think the statutory thing, there are two significant statutory bodies. One, Robert's mentioned, which is the Judicial Appointments Commission. The other is the Civil Service Commission, which is very long-standing, but was made statutory in the dying days of the 2005-2010 government, largely thanks to the then Cabinet Secretary, Gus O'Donnell, who ensured that a modified version of a then bill got through, which put it on a statutory basis. And having talked to various also commissioners, I worked along in parallel with them for 5 years, their view was that it didn't make much difference day to day, but it was very valuable in case of crises and a reinforcement. They were always able to cite the statutory basis to prevent ministers doing things on a whim. And it didn't happen very often, perhaps once or twice in a five-year term of sole service commissioner, but it was there. And I think that is very important. I mean, I think you can look back in the last 10 years and a couple of times when the successive sole service commissioners have referred to their statutory power. So, yes, I think it would be very valuable, both to define the terms of appointment and also the terms of accountability. Those are the parameters I would stress.
And how would you persuade ministers to do that? Because obviously they're quite reluctant to give up discretion.
With considerable difficulty. The only time is really if there's a change of power. I mean, if you look, if I may draw a kind of not too loose a parallel, there was a long debate on the powers of select committees in the late 70s. There was a very good select committee which looked into the processes. And the Conservatives in opposition committed themselves to change. It's very unlikely that that change would have occurred any later than a year or two into the life of the 79 Parliament. It happened quickly. The two metal committees were established, and there they were. I don't think it would have happened later in the process at all. And I think you've got to do it quickly. I think it's highly unlikely that an existing government, which will always see the objections, will always be defending ministerial prerogatives, only under the pressure of crises do changes happen. I mean, it was interesting in the case of the expenses scandal, going back to 2009, when a committee under Tony Wright was set up, wide cross-party support on it. That produced some extremely good proposals, but it was only under that pressure and then brought in by the Conservative government in 2010.
And Robert, do feel free to respond to that, but also I guess Peter has put into our minds there the thoughts of what an incoming Labour government might do in this area. And the one thing that Labour has very clearly said already is that they want to consolidate all of the various, or at least some of the various regulators. And we have been talking about a confusing array of regulators here. So they've proposed consolidating those into one regulator. Is that also a reform, Robert, that you think would be desirable, or would there be problems with that?
This is a proposal that's been made by Angela Rayner as deputy leader of the Labour Party. I think it's an excessively ambitious proposal, and I don't think it's necessary. Yes, as we've been discussing, several of the regulators are weak, and some of them are very weak. But in my mind, the solution is to strengthen them and not to engage in a more wholesale reorganisation, which would take a lot longer in terms of its planning and implementation. And it would encounter a lot of resistance, not least from some of the individual regulators whose offices would be abolished. But if I could come back briefly to the need to put some of these regulators on a statutory basis, we should mention the private members bill recently introduced into the House of Lords by David Anderson, Lord Anderson, which would put on a statutory basis the independent advisor on ministers' interests, the advisory committee on business appointments, and I think Peter's old office, the commissioner for public appointments. And it will be an interesting test of the government's willingness to contemplate such reforms to see what the government response is when the second reading debate happens on that bill. We shouldn't hold our breath if their attitude is the same as Peter's just described to Lord Norton's bill to strengthen the House of Lords Appointments Commission. It seems highly unlikely that they will welcome this, but there will be a parliamentary debate about it.
We're coming to the end of our time. So could I just ask each of you to sum up very, very quickly? You may already have said this, essentially, but what would be your top priority and for the actions that need to be taken in order to improve our system for upholding standards. Peter, do you want to go first?
Well, actually, Robert's given me the cue there. I think the David Anderson bill, to put on a statutory basis, various regulators, is a good preliminary step. I think I'd also link that with putting the Hazardous Appointments Commission, Lord Norton's bill, which will clearly not become law because of the government's hostility to it. That I'd put as another aspect to it to raise the profile of the issue on it. One thing I would say is I think that the regulators themselves, and I did that a bit as when I was appointments commissioner, can do quite a lot to strengthen accountability to Parliament. I went probably beyond my remit in fostering relations with select committees over controversial appointments. I'd write to the chair of the select committee, and I think that the traditional attitude in Whitehall is a suspicion of select committees. I regarded them as allies, both the Public Administration Committee, which is the kind of generic one I was accountable to, and specific departmental committees over particular appointments. And I think that the regulators should regard select committees as allies, not as people wanting to trip them up. And I think that's something which happens without law, can happen now, and actually can alter and move the debate on. And one final thing is that there's a trick that at present, for example, in appointments, the appointment is announced, the preferred candidate in the language goes before a select committee if it's a pre-appointment hearing one. In other words, an important one. However, the Secretary of State, who's nominating the person, doesn't. And I would actually make Secretaries of State much more accountable for their actions. Instead of kind of slightly woolly talk of on the floor of the House, if you've got them precisely saying, I am nominating this person to do this, or I've done that, that form of accountability would have substance, as opposed to a general one of being accountable to the electorate or MPs in general. So those are my kind of immediate suggestions taking forward, which could be done. I think they don't substantially alter the balance, but they would improve the balance and improve accountability and transparency.
And Robert?
I would add just, I think, two more things in addition to the fundamental suggestion we've both been saying, that the regulators who don't currently have a statutory basis should be given a statutory footing. And my two further thoughts would be, I think it's really important to set a strong lead from the top. And I would love to see Rishi Sunak as the new Prime Minister give a major public speech or statement following through on his promise that his government will be one of integrity, professionalism and accountability, to signal a really definite and strong change of tone. And I would wish the same of Keir Starmer. If he wins the next election and he becomes the next Prime Minister, he needs to signal a major change of tone with a major public statement. My final suggestion, a more modest one, is that I would love to see the Committee on Standards of Public Life playing a rather stronger role as a spokesman for the other constitutional regulators, defending them when they come under attack. And actually, they have started to do that. In particular, its chair, Jonathan Evans, Lord Evans, notably did that when Conservative MPs tried to undermine the Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards during the Owen Paterson affair. I think we don't sufficiently recognise that being a regulator can be a lonely task. It's a pretty thankless task. And these individual regulators badly need a support group to explain when they come under attack that they're only doing their job and they need defending by people other than themselves. And that's a role I would like to see the Committee on Standards in Public Life playing a bit more strongly.
Well, thank you so much, Robert and Peter. You've both given some very clear messages there. So let's hope that at least some of the key people are listening to what you're saying. And if you'd like to read more on the themes that we've been discussing, Robert and Peter both contribute regularly to the Constitution Unit blog. We also mentioned a report called Parliament's Watchdogs, Independence and Accountability of Five Constitutional Regulators. That's by Robert Hazel with Marcial Boo and Zachary Pariahpula, and it was published in July. It's available on the Constitution Unit website. Next week, we'll be looking at a new book by our colleague here in the UCL Department of Political Science, Dr. Kate Cronin-Furman. It's called Hypocrisy and Human Rights, Resisting Accountability for Mass Atrocities. And it examines how repressive states have responded to calls for justice in Sri Lanka, Myanmar, Cambodia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and elsewhere. Remember, to make sure you don't miss out on that or other future episodes of UCL Uncovering Politics, all you need to do is subscribe. You can do so on Apple, Google Podcasts, or whatever podcast provider you use. I'm Alan Rennick. This episode was produced by Connor Kelly and Eleanor Kingwell-Benham. Our theme music is written and performed by John Mann. This has been UCL Uncovering Politics. Thank you for listening.